Even people just visiting our part of the world fall in love with it. It is a beautiful place to live, and some of the credit has to go to people who've worked to protect it. Those people include our next guest, who's spent more than four decades working with a handful of environmental groups to make sure the region's beauty and livability continue. Chris Bratt is the latest guest in our series, Stories of Southern Oregon. His story and others appear, or will appear soon anyway, in the Southern Oregon Digital Archives at the Hannon Library of Southern Oregon University. Maureen Battistella is the curator of that. She's with us as well. Maureen, good to see you.
Good morning.
And Chris Bratt, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Good to join you, Jeffrey, for sure.
So 40 years plus since you moved to the Applegate Valley from San Francisco, or from the San Francisco Bay Area anyway, what got you here?
Well, a number of things got me here. One was that I was contracting at the time, before we left, in Marin County, actually, which was a pretty high-powered community in the Bay Area, and had been building houses there and had a small construction company. And my partner wanted to retire. He wanted to sail around the world. So when he made that decision, we folded up the company, and he went on his way, and he spent 5 years sailing around the world, all right? Actually, we met him, Joan and I met him in Greece for one part of that for a short time. And I decided I'd like to do something else myself. We had been building houses and remodeling for people that had a lot of money, and I think what took the frosting on the cake was when we had to put the fifth bathroom in a house we'd been working on. And thought that was a little bit over the top, and maybe I should try something else that was, you know, a little bit more productive for me, at any rate. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I'd like to teach. I had already taken industrial arts major at San Francisco State University, and but I didn't have a teaching credential. But I had been teaching in the apprentice school, actually, carpentry apprentice school. So I took that job for 4 years as teaching, and I kind of liked that. I liked the kids. The administration was really difficult. So, but I learned to live with it, and probably I think for the 4 years I was there, there was a different principal each for those 4 years, and I was happy to see each one of them go. As I, and that kind of led me to after the 4 years, I decided that I was, first of all, let me just say, in the school, I had a program of hiking and stuff for the taking kids out on the weekend and that kind of thing into the Sierras and stuff. So I really got hooked on outside. But that is also in my history. My father and mother were avid people for the environment, actually. They took us to the Sierras whenever they could, although we were pretty poor.
So here was your chance to move out of the Bay Area and live in an environment like
right,
that.
Right, right, right. So, and Joan and I were actually coming to Ashland to see the plays every year. I forget their theme, stay 4 days and see five plays or whatever it was. And so we'd bike and hike and do all those things while we were here. And finally, the kids were getting bigger, of course, getting, you know, they're all teenagers mm-hmm. this time. And so we decided we'd maybe like to take a look around here and see what it was like as far as living here. And so we went to a real estate person who said, well, it's my first day doing real estate. but I heard the Applegate is nice. Would you like to take a ride out there? It's not very far. So we said, oh, sure, you know. So we stopped at the real estate office, another real estate office in Rouge. And the person said, Joan and I were looking at the walls and seeing the pictures and stuff. And there was a place there. I called her over and said, this looks pretty interesting, this place right here. And when we questioned the person, real estate person there about it, she said, oh, well, someone's out there right now. She's taking it off the market. So, and I said, well, can we take a look at it? So we got it all arranged and went out to take a look. And my God, you know, it was a 160 acres of woodland that had been pretty, I'd say, fairly heavily logged, not great deal because there were no access roads on it, really. And so that was the, and it was hard time here in Oregon, and we sold everything we had, and, you know.
So by the time you moved here, it had been 6 years since the first Earth Day. I mean, you obviously appreciated nature. Did you always have an environmental kind of bent like that, about preserving nature?
Well, I certainly, I didn't have it so much when doing those, the carpentry for 18 years in the Bay Area. I was aware of it, all right, and, you know, but, you know, when the lumber keeps piling up and on the job site, you know, you just see those piles coming. You think they're unending, you know. So it was just a natural thing to say, oh, yeah, that's a nice pile of lumber. And I remember there was one job for I worked on for my 3 years, something like that, Henry Dolger, where he owned some redwood, I don't know, site somewhere. And we had the redwood lumber, building the whole house out of redwood, you know, the studs and everything.
I mean, everything. Wow.
Everything, you know. The laborers couldn't even carry the joists. They were so heavy, you know, full, so wet, you know, right. So green. So, but I mean, it was things like that took place, but I never registered, you know, who did what and how it was all arranged beyond, you know, the milling of the lumber.
Right, and that probably all changed once you started actually owning some woodland. We'll come back and pick the conversation up there with Chris Bratt. He's our latest guest in Stories of Southern Oregon. Maureen Battistella from Southern Oregon University's Digital Archives found Chris for her archive and has shared him with us, and we'll get back to talk more with him about his activities, including working for several different environmental groups over the years in the Applegate Valley. Been out there for 42 years almost now. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email. We have an email already congratulating Chris for his many years of work. We'll come back to that and talk more with Chris when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're continuing our series of interviews called Stories of Southern Oregon with people who are slowly populating the archive, the Southern Oregon Digital Archive. Maureen Battistella is the curator of that. She's in the studio with me. But we have with us as our premier guest, Chris Bratt, who has been living for about 42 years in the Applegate Valley, working for a variety of environmental groups along the way, has been instrumental in some fairly groundbreaking moves to regulate and move ahead with forest projects that a lot of people can agree on. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Chris Bratt, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned that when you were working as a carpenter, you were using all this lumber. I mean, built an entire house out of redwood with incredibly heavy joists and stuff like that. So once you got up here, though, and were owning 160 acres, some of which had been logged already, is this when it began to occur to you, oh, this is where all this lumber came from?
Exactly. It's pretty interesting when you live in the midst of the forest, you know, and I find out I'm really a forest dweller rather than a city dweller. Mm-hmm. And, you know, coming from San Francisco, they wouldn't like to hear that, probably. But it was a revelation for me because it kind of culminated a whole group of my ideas. I could work in the wood, you know, in the woods, take it from the, you know, how it's just growing to some other, you know, development in that process. And I got very interested in the small diameter stuff that grows on our place. It's the greatest wood in the world. Douglas fir is just unbelievable anyway, you know, but this slow growing and, you know, and we don't utilize it like we should. I mean, that's what is really needed rather than the old growth trees. Let them be, that's for sure.
So small diameter, like how small?
Well, they take them down commercially to about 8 inches, I think, something like that. But smaller than that, there's not much use. Poles or, you know, some pretty... we tried in the Applegate, we had adaptive management of the area, I think you knew about that, which allowed the BLM and the Forest Service to, over the period of the time under the Northwest Forest Plan, to experiment with some of those smaller diameters. Sent stuff away to the Forest Service, the laboratory in Wisconsin, a whole bunch of things, what it could be used for. Mm-hmm. They found all the things came back, all the ideas came back as being really plausible, but there's no equipment, there's no money being applied to that. I mean, when I think of it, I think of certainly making finger-jointed processes, grinding it and putting it back together in another form, mm-hmm. you know, all these things that would be really advantageous. But we're still in that kind of idea that big trees are the thing that are the money trees.
You cut down big trees, you make slabs of wood out of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, it's just faster and easier and everything, just, you know.
There's no reconfiguring of stuff and putting things
Although the Boise Cascade has a, I don't know if you knew it, they're making an old growth log right here in Medford.
Is that the cross-laminated stuff?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Unbelievable. 4x4x66 feet long. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like a tree, a monstrous tree, you know. Uh-huh. And then they start cutting it up into all these little pieces, but it's their moneymaker.
Uh-huh.
It really is. But to try to get these folks and the mills and stuff to do something besides 2x4s and wood, you know, just general framing wood and stuff, really difficult.
So was there one particular issue or timber sale or something that kind of got you into motion in Southern Oregon?
Yeah, there really was. A young woman came to the door. I think it was just a short time after we had been there. My parents came. It must have been at least 6 months because I kind of fixed up a place next door for my parents to live. And so we were eating dinner one evening about 6 o'clock, I would guess, and knock on the door. And it was a young woman that I'd never seen before. Said, I just wanted to inform you, you know, the BLM is going to be doing a timber sale right next to you and right up the road. And they're going to herbicide all over the place. And there's a group of us that don't think that's very good. And we're having a meeting, and would you like to come? And she gave me all the details. And my mother was sitting at the table, didn't say anything, but when the woman left, she said, Christopher, I think you should do something about that.
It was a push from your mother.
Right. So that was the impetus. I went to the meeting, and they made me a co-chairperson.
So it began with spraying. Okay.
Yeah.
Maureen, I think you had a
yeah, that was with Paul Tipton, wasn't it?
It was.
You and Paul Tipton were co-chairs.
Yeah. Paul Tipton's another old, long-time applicator. Yeah. And, you know, he found community there, mm-hmm. as we all have, you know, and but that became really important for him.
How naturally did that group coalesce? Was it a difficult process?
Well, it wasn't difficult for me, you know, kind of coming from a working class family, you know, and a big family. It was just like they were part of the family because we had potlucks and we'd, you know, get apples together and have, you know, a big free-for-all with the kids and everything, you know. And it was just, you know, great community stuff, a lot of potluck kinds of things. And then we formed a little company, about 8 of us, Billy Mountain Builders, it was called. and it had a couple of women in it, too. So we were trying to make work in Applegate because there wasn't much work at that time for the community, you know. And it went on for a while, and everybody found out that some of them didn't like any carpentry, and some of them loved it. And so they kind of went their various ways. And but a number of us stuck around to make it work.
So we're talking to Chris Bratt here as part of our Stories of Southern Oregon series. Maureen Battistella, the curator of the series, is in the studio as well. How many have you kept track ever of how many different environmental groups you've been involved with?
No, I've never counted them.
Because I'm looking at it, I see SOCATS, which is like the Citizens Against Toxic Sprays,
yeah.
Headwaters, which has morphed into the Geosense Institute. You were all on the board until about 2 years ago, right?
Yeah.
TREE, the Rogue Institute for the Ecology and Economy. You've done work with the Jefferson Nature Center, the Applegate Neighborhood Network. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's exciting. Mm-hmm. It's very exciting. And there are a lot of exciting people as well. I mean, I think I told Maureen that the women have influenced my life so much. You know, it was just amazing. And the people that I work with in the environmental movement, the women, are just the greatest. I mean, I don't know if you remember Phyllis Cribbe, the woman in Grants Pass who was really initial person getting rid of herbicides being used in the forest nationwide. Mm-hmm.
You know. So it went from being concerned about sprays to the timber sales themselves.
Well,
and I know,
that's because the pesticide use was being used to increase the cut in the public land timber, the Forest Service and BLM timber sales.
So the desirable trees would grow faster?
Yes, exactly right. You know, that you get rid of all the unwanted vegetation, and the unwanted vegetation was a bunch of other trees, you know, madrone and oak and a whole bunch of things like that. And that, you know, that's what threw me. I couldn't believe that that was happening, you know, for these money trees. And that, and they, you know, they almost insisted they could go grow trees on a doorknob.
Right.
You know,
cue ball was the one I heard at the time, too. But yeah.
Well, you know, they poured a lot on, too. Yeah. I mean, they had a, you know, the BLM especially, they had a program down here for about 10 years showing all their, what they call their poorest lands, trying to get them to come up to par so they could be called forest lands so they could cut more timber. Mm-hmm. And they just spent, I think, $10 million.
Was that fir?
Fir.
Forestry intensified research.
Right.
Yeah.
You remember that?
I do indeed, because they were the ones who said they could grow trees on a billiard ball.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Doorknob.
Well, I said doorknob. Sure, you know, that's out of my background. You know,
because you installed a lot of doors. So Chris Pratt, working for environmental groups, this can't be easy work. I mean, it's a labor of love, clearly, but there's a level of detail to be able to take and argue a position, and of course, then there's the hostility you engender by opposing work that people have money riding on.
Well, of course, I'm sad about the hostility because don't feel I'm a hostile person along those lines. I support really BLM and Forest Service as federal agencies that are doing a good job in the forest or should be doing a good job in the forest. But the pressures, the political pressures, are just something else again. And so that makes it really difficult when it's every time there's an election, you got a different person running the organization, you know. And to keep the money coming into the community, like, with the ONC lands on the BLM, I mean, they're insisting that they got to cut trees, you know, up to a certain amount. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's out there, I'll tell you that. That's how I feel about it. I mean, after all these years of looking at it, I don't think they have that, especially if they're not going to do anything with a small diameter, you know.
So if they're just going to want to take out the big trees, then
I mean,
not enough.
Because they're almost all gone anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, we probably have less than 10% of any of old growth here, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's that's the sad part. And as I said, the it's surprisingly jolly in the environmental community.
Really?
I would say, you'd think it would be a little bit difficult, but you know, people, when they're focused on these issues, they do their best. And Chris, they work for nothing.
They truly do. Chris Pratt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's our latest in the series Stories of Southern Oregon, found and curated by Maureen Battistella at the Southern Oregon Digital Archive at Southern Oregon University. Chris and Maureen in the studio with me. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I saw you most as a reporter during the Applegate partnership years, when this effort you had to bring people who did want to cut some wood and people who were generally opposed to cutting wood, tried to get them together, the places where they could agree. And it led to the inclusion of adaptive management areas, including the Applegate adaptive management,
in the
Northwest Forest Plan of
1993.
So was there must have been a sense of pride about that.
It is. I mean, it still is with me. I mean, I think it's the only way to go. I mean, and that's one of the problems. The industry doesn't seem to want to come to the table ever. I mean, it's always they've had some kind of a deal with the agencies about the agencies having to really supply them with timber. And so what's there to talk about except, you know, send me the timber, you know. And so, but when you want to sit down and talk about how to do it and where to do it and how to make it do it the best way and all that kind of stuff, it's really rugged to get them to really take a role. And I think it's really necessary for that to happen if you're going to really make some successful arrangement.
So you don't think the dreams of the AMA got quite to where you'd hoped they might have gotten?
No, I. Well, it's a. Yeah, I think Jack Shipley and I disagree a little bit on what the partnership never litigated anything.
Uh-huh.
I don't. They may have agreed with some of the litigation, but we never did litigate, and that was one of the ideas, not to raise that ruffle of feathers that much, But there are plenty of people, and even me on the outside, litigating, doing the litigation, a lot of litigation, just in trying to enforce the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jack is pretty upset that after all these years, of trying to work out these things, and they take his adaptive management area away. Recently the BLM just dropped it like a hot potato.
There is no more AMA.
There is no more AMA for them. Mm-hmm. Forest Service still is adhering with it.
Oh, the Forest Service is, okay, but not BLM. Sure.
Yeah, right. And he's quite upset, I would imagine that he dreams at night that that someone did him in, a little bit there. Here we had a chance to experiment with the community and doing a good job taking the wood out and wood coming out and all those things. And it was, that's the nature of how it's done presently.
Grab the headphones if you want. I want to take a call here from somebody who's been waiting patiently on the phone, and that would be Marley in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Chris Brad in Stories of Southern Oregon.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to share a memory, first of all, and then a question. Excuse me. I was raised in a town in Marin County, Kentfield, and it was a very beautiful town on the trailhead up Mount Tamalpais. And when I was a teeny little girl, and maybe even when I was going to kindergarten, I would walk to school with my older brothers and sister. And I'd walk through a meadow, and it was just a very natural paradise, especially in the spring when the wildflowers were growing and the strawberries were eventually there, and the trees were there, and we'd walk past our neighbor's upper fence. And then eventually the land on that was a meadow on was sold, and then somebody cut with a tractor to build the house, and all that was gone. And I think that had a huge effect on me,
mm-hmm.
and it became like a gash,
sure,
in that place. And then eventually, of course, I got older, and I was born in 47, so I was a little bit not quite into the ecology stuff that was going on starting in colleges, but one of our doctors was Martin Griffin, who...
Marley, we're a little short on time. Can you move to your question?
It was the Audubon Society, but the thing that comes back to me, and I'm trying to ask this question, if I can, with some relevance to what I'm saying, is that when I go to purchase a piece of land to buy a house, sometimes in Washington, Oregon, or California, I noticed that they used as a promotion to buy the place the amount of the logs that could be cut. And I thought, do I want to buy a house and then have the whole scene of logs cut by somebody and no longer have what I came there to enjoy? That was all.
So on your land or on the adjacent land?
On the adjacent land.
On the adjacent land. Okay. So that's been an issue in your life, I imagine.
For sure. That's a difficult one because I think most people wouldn't be so bad. It wouldn't be so bad for them if there was a way of treating the land adjacent to private landowners in a little bit different way than just clear cutting it and putting herbicide on it, which is what they were doing during those early days.
Sure.
And so it would pay for the BLM to and the Forest Service as well. But the Forest Service, of course, owns the upper elevations, which don't have so many people around them. To keep that in mind when they're planning some of these things.
So we have an email here from Susie in the Applegate Valley who says, thank you, Chris, for your many years of dedication. The people and forests of the Applegate appreciate your efforts. What's your advice for younger environmentalists about how to stick with it for the long haul without burning out?
Well, burnout is a tough one because the environmental movement, because there's not much money to be made, even if you are getting paid. And I will say there are some people, especially in the other larger organizations that get paid very well, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that it tests your your whole look at life. You know, can you do that? Then do it well and stick with it. And some people can do it, and some people can't do it. So that's the conclusion that I've come to. But the people that stick it out are pretty interesting. Let me just say.
What a great way to cap off what we've been talking about here. Chris Bratt has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Uh-huh. He is the latest in our stories of Southern Oregon, a longtime environmental activist and woodworker and teacher in the Applegate Valley. Maureen Battistella, who curates the stories of Southern Oregon at the Southern Oregon Digital Archive, has been here as well. Chris, good to see you. Maureen, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jeffrey. Thanks very much. Huh?